From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's show, we talk with Mark Olson and Will Sheffer about their HBO series Getting On, a dark comedy set in the geriatric extended care wing of a hospital. Season 2 began this week. Olson and Sheffer drew on their own experiences advocating for their mothers in nursing homes.
You know, you have to learn this dance, like, I'm going to get that nurse to give my mother another painkiller, but I'm going to do it in a nice way so that they don't hate me.
Olson and Sheffer also created the HBO series Big Love. Later, film critic David Edelstein reviews Foxcatcher, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two 20th century classical music compositions reinterpreted by the Eric Hoffbauer Jazz Quintet. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
I'm Dr. Jenna James. How are you? You know where you are? You're in the Billy Barnes Extended Care Unit.
I'm just filling in until they get someone permanent. I'm actually a real doctor over at the hospital.
The HBO comedy series Getting On, which began its second season Sunday, is set in the Women's Geriatric Extended Care Wing of a Southern California hospital. That was Laurie Metcalf as a doctor who considers working there a demotion. Getting On is told from the perspective of doctors and nurses dealing with patients near death who have dementia and often don't know where they are. The stressed-out nurses are dealing with body fluids, end-of-life issues, and doctors and patients who don't appreciate what they do. But yes, this is a comedy. New York Times TV critic Neil Genslinger wrote, "This fictional hospital unit, in all its ridiculousness, feels somehow true to life." Our guests are the creators of Getting On, Mark V. Olson and Will Sheffer, who also created the HBO series Big Love. Getting On is adapted from the BBC series of the same name, but has a lot of new material that comes out of experiences Sheffer and Olson had when their mothers were in care facilities at the end of their lives. Terry spoke to them last year during the first season of Getting On. Here's a scene from the first episode. After some fecal matter is discovered on a chair in the common area, the head nurse of the unit, Don Forchette, played by Alex Borstein, is going over the incident report prepared by nurse Dee Dee Ortley, played by Niecy Nash. It's Dee Dee's first day on the unit. Don, the head nurse, speaks first.
Found a feces in a chair. No. The incident reports need to be really, really specific.
Okay, what else should I put?
Well, for starters, it's not a feces, it's just feces.
But, I mean, it wasn't a gang of them, it was just one piece.
But, yeah, but there's no singular form for feces. It's not feces or a feces, it's just feces. Who found it?
Me.
And when did they find it?
I found it. See, this is my name right here.
Technically, because it's a potential agent of infection, we would have environmental services come down to collect it, but the backlog is horrendous. So I'm just going to go ahead and have you red bag it.
If it'll make it quicker, I could just pick it up with a Kleenex, wipe off the chair with some bleach. Boom.
Yeah, that might be what you do at home, but you cannot do that in the hospital.
Will Sheffer and Mark Olson, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the new series. I want you to describe the premise in your words.
We used to say you can't avoid death and taxes in this culture, but it's gotten to the point now where you can't avoid death, taxes, and caring for the elderly. And really, you know, we are all dealing with this now, and we wanted to find a safe, funny, warm place that we could come as an audience and experience that.
It's funny. I think both Will and I have in the, over the course of the last 5-10 years, been devoted to the care of our mothers who are aging, and I think we've both had different takeaways from it and different pieces that we've learned or have become important to us or whatnot. An additional item for me on this show is going through my mother's care and going through it with her extended team of caregivers. There's such a value to the work that those people do that we kind of wanted to take a different approach to the workplace comedy. And instead of dramatizing or highlighting the ways in which the workplace dehumanize us and make us invisible and whatnot, we wanted to actually celebrate the workplace and celebrate the fact that in many instances, particularly amongst this group of caregivers, it gives value to a life. And that's something that was very much on at least both our minds, I think.
Yes, but.
Yes, but. Yes, but. Yes,
yes,
but.
Yes, yes, but. You know, there's one of the nurses in there, Dee Dee, is just, she has such a gift for wiping somebody's behind in the gentlest, most respectful way, knowing how to lift somebody out of a chair and clean up puke and stuff. She's just wonderful at what she does. She's incredibly undervalued. But, you know, there's other people who work there who are really like going through the motions but think that they are the most wonderful caregivers and they're, you know, in touch with death and really like they're not even paying attention half the time. and you know, for those of us who've had loved ones in facilities, we've seen both extremes.
I think, you know, in our show, you know, we love all these characters, even the crazy ones who are sort of all wrapped up in their own egos and sometimes miss the point of what they're doing. And I think you're right, Terry, that we've witnessed both extremes. You know, Mark's mom we brought her out here to California, and out here there are these little boarding care places where you can have skilled nursing that are sort of the opposite of what our show dramatizes, which is a more institutional wing, a more, you know, nursing home-like, you know, wing of a hospital. And we used to love going to see Mark's mom, you know, and be with the three or four women who had Alzheimer's there and the family who cared for them, because we laughed a lot there and we felt like we were in a family. My mom in New York City, on the other hand, would be shipped out of a hospital into one of these rehabs, and I'd have to go get her out, which was a real process of, like, getting her out under orders that I should not do that by the doctors there, you know. And that was the experience I think you're referring to, where it just seemed like an elder mill, where the elderly were ignored. And we're sort of trying to mix both those experiences that we had and also do something with our characters where you can fall in love with even the most careless of our caregivers.
So, Will, you had to fly from the West Coast to the East Coast when your mother was sick?
Yes, I did. I had grown up on the East Coast, and she was still there. And
the story of Big Love was both of us being on the West Coast, taking care of our mothers. Will's in New York City, mine in mid-state Nebraska. And so we sort of alternated weekends flying out from the last flight, you know, Friday night from Burbank, me landing in Omaha at midnight and getting into, you know, my mom's house at 2 a.m. to make sure the food was good, the caretakers were on schedule, her hygiene was good, the doctor's appointments were being met, everything that everyone who's tended to a, you know, a parent in their latter years deals with. To get on the plane at 5 a.m. Monday back to Los Angeles in the stages for Big Love, and Will in turn making that same schlep from Burbank to New York. And so the show kind of grew out of that process for us.
Okay, well, knowing this and knowing the trips that you had to make so frequently in the final time of your mother's life, there's a scene I want to play from your new series, Getting On. And this is a scene in which Molly Shannon plays the daughter of one of the women in this extended care facility. And Molly Shannon, like, flies in, you know, it's been a 7-hour trip, and she wants to talk to the doctor, and she has her ideas of what the doctor should be doing, which, of course, irritates the doctor. And I think most people who have a parent in a geographically distant place has experienced something similar to this,
yes,
to this scene. So this is Molly Shannon as the patient's daughter, and Laurie Metcalf as Dr. Jenna James.
Dr. Jenna James, how can I help?
Yeah, my mother's in a lot of pain.
Yes, we're doing the very best we can to alleviate that.
Yes, it's just that I know nothing about this, of course, but I did read on the internet.
We caution relatives not to do too much Googling, a little knowledge.
I did drive 7 hours to get here, so I feel a responsibility to be my mom's advocate. And I did read that people with my mother's level of pain should be on either tramadol or a more like morphine-based drug like Oramorph.
Well, the internet is awash with other drugs that people could be on, but rest assured, we are doing our very best.
I printed up this with all respect.
Yeah,
to
no, well, it could field, be this, could be that, but I've considered the many choices.
I think what Dr. James is saying is that we right. There's always alternatives.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It could be oxycodone, hydrocodone, hydromorphone, Percocet, pethidine, morphine, Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
You know what? I really feel like nobody's listening to me. I'm trying to show you this, and I feel like nobody's letting me talk.
You're absolutely talking, and I'm absolutely listening.
No, I'm trying to tell you that she is in pain. She needs more help in dealing with her chemotherapy.
No, there's no chemo.
What do you mean there's no chemo?
Well, the tumors were much more invasive than we thought and were well beyond chemo. Dr. Lucchini said that this was all explained on the phone.
This was not explained to me. Dr. Lucchini told me that he would be sending her to rehab.
Yes, well, sometimes rehab is the palliative. I'm sure there's a note in the notes.
Well, may I see the notes?
No, you won't be able to
understand the notes. But they're my mom's notes, so I think I have a right to see my mom's notes. I'd like to see the notes.
Yes, but they are misunderstood or misinterpreted, and usually in very negative ways. For example, SOB, that's not going to mean what you think it's going
to mean. So palliative? So what are you saying? Are you saying she's dying?
Yes.
Okay, that's a scene from Getting On, and my guests, Will Sheffer and Mark Olson, are the creators and writers of this new HBO series. So did you have scenes in your life that were similar to that, where you kind of flew in and either found out something that you should have already known, but nobody told you, or you had suggestions that the doctor didn't really want to hear?
We go through our scripts, and we can usually assign etiology. This is a 90% I experienced it. This is a 10% you experienced that. This is probably a 2/3 Will experienced and a 1/3 Mark experienced. Most of those moments Will experienced with his mom in New York, sort of, you know, landing in the land of Stalinist, Maoist double medical doublespeak and trying to penetrate it.
And my mom, you know, like, just hated being in hospital, so I'd get it from both ends, because, like, she'd inevitably, like, you know, say something like, "What took you so long?" You know, when I got there, and just would be like, "Get me out of here!" And, you know, and the nurses would look at me with sheepishly, like, "Oh boy, you got it hard." You know, my mom still had all her marbles, and she was a tough cookie, but yeah, you know, this kind of having to advocate, you know, endlessly for your loved one, it takes all of your energy, and you have to really suck it up. And, you know, I would Google things, and knowing that it was probably not a good idea, but, you know, I'd go right up to the doctor and just get into it with them. And of course, doctors don't like being challenged. They're the experts. And but this was my experience largely with dealing with doctors. And you know, but I think advocacy is the word that we learn as we have to, like, fight our way through the medical system.
Yes, and the Molly Shannon scene also reminded me of trying to walk that line between advocate and pest. And you never know which side of the line the medical staff perceives you as being on.
I think that's spot on, you know, because you have to learn this kind of strategy of, like, I'm going to be firm, yet I'm not going to alienate anybody, you know. So it's this dance that you do when you get to the hospital of, like, I'm going to get that nurse to give my mother another painkiller, but I'm going to do it in a nice way so that they don't hate me, you know. And there have been all sorts of, I have lots of stories of, like, I fired nurses from rooms.
Well, yeah, I think actually I took a whack on the first draft of that scene. And part of it was channeling anecdotes that Will brought back, you know, over the years with his mother's care in New York. And part of it was just eavesdropping on his care of me when I was in UCLA hospital with some major surgery 4 or 5 years ago. And just, it was sort of an armchair seat watching him as an advocate, trying to fire nurses, trying to get different antibiotics, trying to get, you know, a different regimen of healthcare and a different treatment plan going. And it pretty fierce stuff.
I think I learned my lesson with Mark, actually, that I was a little too aggressive, so that when I got to my mom...
Well, it is true. I'd be lying in my bed at 6 in the morning and hear the clip-clop of his shoes coming down the linoleum hallway and think, oh, God, here comes trouble.
Why would you think here comes trouble?
Because within 10 minutes, he's going to be at it with the doctors when they're on the rounds, and I'm going to be sitting here on morphine, kind of watching this pageant going on in front of me as my beloved is fiercely advocating for my medical benefit, and perhaps not initially in his first outing in this capacity, doing it in the most diplomatic of manners.
So, Will, true. I have to ask you, how does it make you feel to hear Mark say that? The here comes trouble part.
Well, I you know, it's funny. He tells two versions of the story. He tells one where the clip-clop of the shoes was the most beautiful sound he ever heard. And now I hear the version about the clip-clop is more like the Wicked Witch of the West, you know, coming to create a disaster. But, you know, I think that it's a learned skill, you know, and luckily or unluckily, I had to do it a lot, you know, and I think I became a good advocate, you know, by making mistakes and finally learning that there was a way to sort of navigate the system and be firm and not be a pest, as you say, but really sort of get what my mom needed done. And, you know, sometimes it was getting her out of a place. I have to say that was sometimes under her pressure of, you know, get me out of here, get me out of here. And that would sort of fire me up. And there was more than one time where we just wound up leaving a quote-unquote rehab with the doctor saying, well, you go without my medical advisement, but I can fill this bed in a minute, so it doesn't really matter to me.
Mark Olson and Will Sheffer are creators of the HBO series Getting On, which began its second season Sunday. They also created HBO's Big Love. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's interview with Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, creators of the HBO series Getting On, which began its second season Sunday.
There's a really nice scene in which the most caring nurse, Dee Dee, played by Niecy Nash, who had been on Reno 911, she's very gentle with this, you know, very old woman who is on the commode, and Niecy wipes her behind and helps her up just in the most respectful way. And then when you're thinking, wow, like the patient and the healthcare worker, you know, the nurse, they're just like really bonding. And then the patient says to her, can you help me find my keys, dear? I have to get to the office. And you realize that, you know, this patient is living in the past completely. She has no idea where she is or why she's there. And it just made me think about how difficult it is when someone you love is a patient in a facility and the people taking care of them will never really know who your loved one is because of dementia or because they're too sick to explain. And it's just this, just a really sad reality.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we try and like show that reality and then bring some laughter into it so it's safe to go there. But Mark, do you want to talk about
that? And boy, there's so many you push a lot of buttons with that one, or a lot of questions come up, or a lot of feelings come up. When my mother was diagnosed with non-stroke aphasia in 2001 or 2002, which is akin to Parkinson's, there's a slow growing attack on the capacity to speak, understand speech, read words, that ultimately leads to dementia. And over the course of the last 10 years, that was her progression. And as she, you know, when there was that first diagnosis of aphasia, I had that poetic little moment that was quite narcissistic, that, oh my God, there will come a day when she says, I love you for the very last time. You know, and that was sort of my self-involvement with it initially. But over the course of those years, I certainly learned that day did come, certainly. But the relationship did not die in any way, shape, or form. It continued and progressed and had great value. But what long road back to this. But when my mother finally lost the capacity to speak, because she was a very articulate woman, a very verbal woman, with a very storied past, when she lost that ability to speak and she was left with caretakers, it saddened me tremendously. And it didn't matter who the caretaker was, good caretaker, bad caretaker, it didn't matter, that they would never know who this woman was. They would never know, you know, her escapades in the U.S. Navy or her adventures in the South Seas. They'd never know her interest in linguistics. They'd never know her rich, deep sense of humor. And it hurts. It hurts on a deep, true level that we really didn't know what to do with except put it in a show, in a way.
And be with it. I mean...
And be with it.
One of the things that was so... I think what caring for our mothers really taught us all the way up through the hospice experience was like that this part of life, you know, that so many people are afraid of, and for good reason, it's kind of a privilege to be able to be there when you can. So we would go over and see Mark's mom. He'd go over a lot and talk, you know, for hours. carrying on these one-sided conversations with her. And it always touched me to see how much energy it took to carry on a conversation when you're the only speaker. And I'd go and...
It's not that different than a marriage.
Well, you see, Big Love was about marriage, and luckily we were married at the time, and still are, that we were writing that. And this is about caring for the elderly, and we were doing that at the time we were writing it, too. But, you know, I think that that act of carrying on conversations with someone who can't speak to you and being with them as they're dying, there was a kind of sense of privilege that we began to feel. And sort of a sense that, gosh, you know, I was so afraid of this. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be here. But being here is starting to feel like a good thing, a good part of life, something that we avoid in this culture, but that actually is a rich experience, albeit painful. It actually is so much a part of life. And so many people never get to be in it.
Mark Olson and Will Sheffer will be back in the second half of the show. They created the HBO series Getting On, which began its second season Sunday. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees now available 100% online at online.asu.edu. From eSurance, with a mobile app that lets users report claims, get a quote, and monitor repairs at eSurance.com. Welcome to the modern world. And from Angie's List, offering consumer reviews for more than 19 years and providing online shopping and scheduling for local services. Angie'sList.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new CDs of 20th century classics, including Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, reinterpreted by the Eric Hofbauer Quintet. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film Foxcatcher, and more with Mark Olson and Will Sheffer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview with Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, creators of the HBO comedy series Getting On, which began its second season Sunday. Getting On is set in the geriatric extended care unit of a Southern California hospital. It focuses on doctors and nurses caring for patients at the end of life and dealing with the hospital bureaucracy. Some of the storylines are drawn from their experiences when their mothers were in care facilities at the end of their lives. Olson and Sheffer also created the HBO series Big Love. Terry spoke to them last year during the first season of Getting On.
Although getting on is based in part on your personal experiences. It's also adapted from a BBC series, which was that also called Getting On?
It was.
So how did you find out about that series, and why did you decide to do like an American adaptation of it?
We decided to do the American adaptation because it was stunningly close to some ideas that we had been working up. Over the course of a couple of years, we were batting ideas back and forth on our commute up to Big Love every morning about an adult woman and her two adult daughters. So the architecture of the three women working in the elder care industry, with much the same feel as the show, showing, you know, the class differences and the comedic moments. And serendipitously, we were on a trip to London 3 years ago, and Jo Brand's face was all over the tube from a new book she had out.
She's the star of the British series.
She is the star of the British series. Googling her in the hotel room one night led us to YouTube clips of the show, and I remember it was like 3 a.m. when I was watching them, jet lagging, watching them, and shaking Will and waking him up and going, "Oh my God, you've got to watch this. It's exactly what we want to do. It's just spot on." And that led us down the road.
And we were lucky enough to, as soon as Big Love was over, our first meeting was with our producing partners, BBC Worldwide. Jane Tranter, the head of that organization, had run the BBC and Getting On, this little show in England, you know. Also, it was the last show she had greenlit. And I remember her saying to us, "You want to do an adaptation of Getting On after Big Love? That's crazy. It's such a small little gem of a show. You know, don't you want to do something big and grand and operatic?" And we said, "No, we want to do this." And she got the rights for us, and we were able to talk to the British women who created it, and they were lovely. And we used an awful lot of their material, of course, mixed in with our own, to make this show. And the whole documentary style of the show and the comedic treatment of these very kind of difficult medical, you know, situations is based on their treatment of the material.
So there's some wonderful actresses playing the older patients in the extended care facility in your series, and I'm wondering what casting them is like. Are they retired actresses?
And the extras are mostly just you know, women who have gotten into extra acting work after their retirement. And so we had a wonderful extra casting agent, and also, you know, extras casting agent, who brought us wonderful faces, and we were able to see who we really, you know, could work with. And sometimes we'd give them a speaking bid, and we just, you know, here we are in Southern California, the land of face work, and you know, we knew that we wanted our show to be authentic, and we had to find authentic elderly people to fill out a lot of the background.
Well, and that's true as to the extras. We wanted a great tableau, a great backdrop, a great background of great faces, as it were. It's almost Norma Desmond-esque. We wanted faces in our show, but there's such an amazing pool of incredibly gifted actresses, you know, in up in years, and I don't want to say that it was, you know, ripe for the picking, because these women do obviously still work. June Squibb, for God's sakes, is, you know, legendary in the film Nebraska that's just out. But, you know, and when Ann Gilbert came in, she has a nice role that runs the course of the season, and she was Millie in the Dick Van Dyke Show, and when Ann, she was Birdie. Millie Helper, you know, that's who she is, and when Ann Jeffries came in, it's like, my God,
Ann
she
Jeffries
goes back.
From Topper?
Yes.
The ghostess, you know, with the mostess?
She was Donna in episode 2, I mean, or episode 3, I'm sorry.
No, episode 2.
Episode
You're right.
2, yeah. Who played the, who had the one featured moment in a film in the 40s called Singer in a Gift Box in our show.
Oh, and they Google her. They find out she was beautiful when she was young. Wow.
Exactly. You know, and June Squibb, it's like writing for these women is joyous. Having them on the set is joyous. You know, when we did Big Love and got to hang around Harry Dean Stanton, you know, we developed a keen appreciation for Hollywood legends, and well, Harry's, you know, more than just a legend, is an amazing human being. But these women are they're treasures, and we adore being able to write for them and give them parts.
So I have to ask you, you are legally married now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are.
So has that affected your health care? I know you could probably afford health care. I mean, you do HBO series. You're not poor. But still, has it affected either like your health care or your ability to do things like have all the perks, like if one of you or one of your loved ones is in the hospital, to have all the perks that are allowed only immediate family?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when I had to take care of Mark at UCLA, we weren't legally married. And I remember having to sort of fight my way sometimes into a room and say, I am his domestic partner. And, you know, it was tough and sort of, I guess, demeaning would be the word that comes to mind. But we have a good healthcare policy through the Writers Guild of America, thank goodness. But if before we were legally married, before this year, we were to pool our health care as a married couple and take benefits as a domestic partner, let's say, before we were married, we had to pay taxes on those benefits. And now that we're married, that goes away.
And God knows it's made just you know, when DOMA fell and the federal government changed its stripes, it made just incredible differences in you know inheritance and the macabre Byzantine way we had to structure our estates and whatnot to
as
you know,
we
protect
think,
each other.
As we think about getting on, you know, ourselves as a gay married couple, you know, it was always really scary to figure out what was going to happen with our, you know, with our lives, how we were going to take care of each other, how if one of us died first, it was going to affect the other. And I have to say that it was a tenuous situation still for us, you know, as a not recognized married couple in California, federally. And, you know, this year we filed our first, you know, joint tax form together. And that was a huge symbolic step for us. I mean, this has been a huge experience being recognized federally as a married couple.
Since you mentioned thinking ahead to the future about getting on yourselves, having just done this series, Getting On, do you worry about what happens, you know, years from now if you know, if you get, you know, chronically ill or dementia or something and you end up needing full-time care?
Terry.
Yes.
Worried about it. It consumes every waking thought that we have on our commutes to work, standing in line at the bank. It's all we think about. We have internal debates. We toss coins. Who's going first? I'm not sticking around if you're not here, and you're not gonna leave me holding the bag. And
do we have enough railings in our house?
Yeah, we redid our house over the last couple of years, and trying to think prospectively, but not wanting to tip our cards too much, we insisted that we needed a few more wash rag hangers in the, you know, in the bathtub, when really we were basically talking about grab bars and trying to be prepared for the future. So, you know, is this doorway wide enough for that wheelchair in 30 years? Or, you know, of course, you can't, having gone through it, you can't help but, you know, look ahead. Obsessively about what it will be like for you as well.
So the lung care facility is called the Billy Barnes Extended Care Facility. There's a Billy Barnes who wrote the song "Have I Stayed Too Long at the Fair." You didn't name it after him, did you?
Oh yes, we did.
Did you really?
We did.
The song, you know. Well, you know, you just say the title of the song.
Oh, I get it. Have I stayed too long at the fair? Oh,
yeah.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because we actually got a message from an email from someone who was friends with Billy Barnes' long-term partner. And so we didn't know that Billy Barnes was gay or that he had a long-term partner. So this all comes full circle. He, through this friend, wrote us saying how much he appreciated that it was named after Billy Barnes. And it moved him so much. And that was just a nice little, yeah, you know, perk.
Well, guess what? We have a copy of his song.
Oh,
I Stayed Too Long at the Fair, so we can end with that.
Oh, that's lovely.
That's really lovely. Nice.
Great. Oh, wow. Oh, what a surprise. Okay. Well, Chef Remarque Olson, it's great to talk with you again. Congratulations on the new series. And thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you.
We always love being here. Thank you.
I wanted the music to play on forever. Have I stayed too long at the fair? I wanted the clown to be constantly clever. Have I stayed too long at the fair? I bought me blue ribbons to tie up my hair, but I couldn't find anybody to care. The merry-go-round is beginning too slow now. Have I stayed too long at the fair? The music has stopped and the children must go now. Have I stayed too long?
Barbara Streisand recorded in 2006. Mark Olson and Will Sheffer spoke with Terry last year. They created the HBO series Getting On, which began its second season this week. It airs Sunday nights at 10:30. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews jazz reinterpretations of some classical pieces. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Boston jazz guitarist Eric Hoffbauer's quintet has two new CDs out, playing 20th century classical music pieces. One is the year's second jazz version of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, following the Bad Plus's version. The other is Olivier Messiaen's very unjazzy quartet for the end of time. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead likes him a lot.
Easy to hear why jazz musicians have taken to the Rite of Spring. Stravinsky's pulsing rhythms, thick bitonal harmonies, and catchy little themes are jazz ready-mades. Eric Hoffbauer's compact quintet makes that plain while recalling the village band from Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale. That's Hoffbauer on guitar with the fine drummer Kurt Newton. Hoffbauer's quintet hit on all of Stravinsky's themes, giving them jazzy articulation and timing. They open them out for improvisations that stay true to the material. The players never fight it. It helps to have musicians comfortable in both worlds, in clarinetist Todd Brunell, trumpeter Jerry Sabatini, and cellist Junko Fujiwara, who sometimes mimics a swinging bass player. Their Stravinsky sounds surprisingly Ellingtonian. We'll be right back. The Rite of Spring is one of two volumes of Eric Hoffbauer's so-called prehistoric jazz, that title taken from a comment Leonard Bernstein once made about the Rite. Volume two is more daring, a recasting of Olivier Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. Hoffbauer's Quintet for the End of Time is for the same versatile band. Playing the Messiaen requires delicacy. The quartet's inseparable from the circumstances of its creation. It premiered and was mostly written at a German POW camp where Messiaen was being held in 1941 and played by captive musicians, including the composer on piano. The quartet deals with time, but not in a pounding Stravinskian way. The slow tempos seem to take the listener out of time, music for prisoners. Messiaen borrowed some timeless melodic material from blackbirds and nightingales, symbols of freedom outside the barbed wire. Messiaen wasn't the only wartime detainee contemplating birds. Ezra Pound saw how birds sitting on wires outside his detention camp looked like notes on a musical staff. There's no guitar in Messiaen's quartet, and Eric Hoffbauer's sixth string can sound jarring when he shadows a written solo line. You can think of guitar's parallel wires as standing in for the camp fence looming in the background. Once in a great while, Eric Hoffbauer's Quintet for the End of Time sounds almost jubilant. Messiaen, after all, did play his way out of prison, like Leadbelly. A sympathetic guard forged some papers and got him released months after the quartet's premiere. Hoffbauer's two smartly arranged, impeccably played volumes of prehistoric jazz are all the more remarkable because the whole project's such a long shot. To pull off the Stravinsky is tricky enough. To jazz up the Messiaen without messing up. Now that is a great escape.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Wondering Sound and is the author of Why Jazz. Eric Hoffbauer's CDs are on the Prehistoric Jazz label. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film Foxcatcher. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The new film Foxcatcher is based on the true story of the wealthy chemical company heir John DuPont and his fraught relationship with two Olympic wrestlers, Mark Schultz and his brother Dave. It's directed by Bennett Miller, who made Capote and Moneyball, and it stars Steve Carell, Channing Tatum, and Mark Ruffalo. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
At the center of the true-life drama Foxcatcher is Steve Carell, as you've never seen or heard him before. He plays John DuPont of The DuPonts, and the performance confirms what F. Scott Fitzgerald said of the rich. They are different from you and me. Oh boy, they're different. Carell tilts his head up at a 45-degree angle, looking down his long beak, which is false, by the way. His inflections are peculiar, rhythmless. He's so abstracted that he's eerie, as if the rules of human intercourse don't apply to him. He's also obsessed with wrestling. The film is set in the late 80s and 90s, and DuPont wants to fund and house and coach a team on his vast estate near Philadelphia, Foxcatcher, that goes all the way to the Olympics. Wealth isn't enough for him. Like many regular Americans, his identity hinges on winning. So he summons Mark Schultz, played by Channing Tatum, a former Olympian who's presently at low ebb.
Do you have any idea why I asked you to come here today?
No.
No. Well, Mark, do you have any idea who I am?
No.
There's some rich guy calls you on the phone. I want Mark Schultz to come visit me. Well, I'm a wrestling coach, and I have a deep love the sport of wrestling, and I wanted to speak with you about your future, about what you hope to achieve. What do you hope to achieve, Mark?
I want to be the best in the world. I want to go to Worlds and win gold. I want to go to the 88 Olympics in Seoul and win gold.
Good. I'm proud of you.
The good thing about that scene is it's deadpan. One bizarre rich guy reaching out of his solipsistic haze to a poor, seriously depressed athlete. It's cloud cuckoo land, played to make you laugh uncomfortably and prepare for a strange journey ahead. Foxcatcher has wowed many critics at festivals. There's talk of awards for Steve Carell. My own response is cooler. After that first meeting between Schultz and DuPont, Bennett Miller directs the next 2 hours in exactly the same key. Tatum and screenwriters E. Max Fry and Dan Futterman never make clear why Schultz is so sunk in gloom from the opening frame. He seems generically tortured. And Carell runs out of variations. All that's left is to watch him get crazier and potentially explosive, while everyone around him pretends not to notice. In real life, some people around DuPont did notice and considered institutionalizing him just before he picked up a gun and committed an act of shocking violence. But Miller wants to create a vacuum in which little is spoken aloud. He doesn't oversell the movie's thesis, but it's easily inferred. Even in America, a man like DuPont can behave with the capricious destructiveness of old monarchs. He can buy himself an Olympic medal. It's a fascinating case study, perfect for a magazine article or book. But his drama, it's one sick joke. You know everything you're going to know about these people from their first scenes. I had a similar problem with Miller and Futterman's acclaimed Capote. Sure, in the title role, Philip Seymour Hoffman killed, but the film itself was sour and ponderous, a long slog exposing Capote's duplicity and self-loathing, with no regard for his art. You don't even get that much out of Foxcatcher. Cinematically, it's more resourceful, but in the end, it's just a bloated true crime story. My favorite character is the most normal, Schultz's brother, Dave, played by Mark Ruffalo. DuPont brings Dave in as a so-called assistant coach, though of course Dave does all the coaching, DuPont being absent and ineffectual. Ruffalo comes off as a real human being, puzzled by his new job, but happy for the opportunity. In the best scene, DuPont sends a film crew to interview Dave on the subject of DuPont's genius as a coach. They want Dave to say he considers DuPont a mentor. I woke up from the stupor the movie put me in when Ruffalo registered subtle disbelief and then struggled to get those words out. It's the only time in Foxcatcher when you don't know what a character will do next.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how UPS is reducing emissions in communities with their growing fleet of natural gas vehicles. Thinkaboutit.org. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at AECF.org. And from Wix.com. Giving business owners the ability to create their own website with the drag-and-drop builder. Learn more at wix.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Shane Harris talks about America's new cyber war and how the NSA's efforts to protect Americans have both weakened U.S. security and proved successful. Harris's new book is At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Join us.